Hey guys, welcome to episode 328. Our guest in a second will be LV Shane, which feel bad for LV. We talk about this. It's not a name that people hear often. I've never heard it until him. And so I think a lot of people call him Elvis Shane or Elvi, or you think it's a typo because it happens with me all the time with Bobby Bones. I mean, I was called in a bowl game last week. And they were promoing my New Year's show. They were like, "And Bobby Jones host." And I'm not even upset anymore because it happens so much. Mostly I just laugh. And I sent the video to Mike and I was like, "Can you give me this so I can post it?"
They just think it can't be a real name.
I know. Same thing with Elvi. Yeah. I'm sure he gets it all the time. But I'll say this about Elvi. I like him a lot. I mean, he has such an interesting look that you would be like, "I'm either going to hate this guy or love this guy." Because bold look, the beard,
the glasses,
but love him. Just love him. Here is my boy from LV Shane. Say hello.
He ain't my blood, ain't got my name.
There you go.
But if he did, I feel the same. I wasn't there.
Basically about having a stepson. Was a number one song. Got so big, he then was like, people are now asking about doing that, My Girl. And he did a little version like that he would do live. He has an album called Backslider, which is really great. And if you love his vibe and what he's about, and we'll play some clips in this interview, I encourage you to check it out. You know, he's born in Caneyville, Kentucky, which I'll say this, and we start the interview with this. He drove down from Kentucky, but he was parked. We do the show from my house, and my wife was driving out and almost hit his car.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Not his fault, but she was like, almost hit somebody's car out there today in our yard. I was like, yeah, that's LV. I don't know. So, you know, big church singer, you know, grew up in the church, singing in the church like a lot of country artists do. We talk about that and just a big fan of the guy. So I'm going to play this for you and be sure to go check out the Keith Urban, the one out. We did it in two parts, but then we decided after a couple weeks, let's just load the whole thing up as a full hour. So you can go back and listen to the hour with Keith Urban. It's up on a past episode. And if you don't mind, and I know people say this all the time, but I'm going to ask you near and dear. We don't say it every week. If you will subscribe to this, if you listen, that would be great because it helps us. If you'll rate it, what's the biggest rating we can get?
5 stars.
If you can give us 5 stars, that helps. We can say this every episode, I guess, but we don't. But if you don't mind doing that, that would be awesome for us, especially on Spotify because that's new.
Yeah,
they
rating.
Now allow you to rate. And so we don't have many ratings on Spotify because of this. So if you don't mind giving us 5 stars, that would help us tremendously. What else do they do? Like review?
You can leave a review.
You know what? I'm not going to ask you to do that. You can if you want, but I don't want to ask too much.
Just the five stars.
If you ask too much, you don't get anything. But thank you. And we're going to play this interview we did with LV Shane. Any thoughts on LV before we go, Mike?
I really like him too.
Yeah.
I felt like I identified a lot with his story, so it was cool getting to talk to him.
All right, here you go, guys. Good to see you, LV.
It's good to see you, man. How you doing?
Pretty good. So what, you had too much coffee today?
I had too much coffee. I stopped in Livingston, Tennessee on my way to Nashville and got coffee. And then I had coffee at First Watch. And then
why into Nashville? Did you drive into Nashville?
Yeah, today? I live in Eastern Kentucky. So.
Oh, I didn't. You still do?
Yeah.
Did you know that, Mike?
I didn't know that.
I lived here for like 5 years. And then just back right after 2020, we bought a house in my wife's hometown when we found out we were pregnant. So
how long of a drive is that to Nashville?
3 hours, but...
So just close enough that you can get here and back if you need to in a day.
Yeah, it's like driving to Walmart at this point. I've done it so many times, you know. It's not a big deal.
So Eastern Kentucky is because, is that where you or your wife grew up, that town?
That's where my wife grew up. She's from a little town called Monticello. And I'm from Caneyville, which is about 3 hours west of there. But like I said, we found out she was pregnant. And we've been doing this back and forth thing. She was working part-time in Nashville and going back and forth because we didn't want to bring Caleb and put him in metro school in Nashville. So he was in a Christian school in small town Kentucky, and it was like, it just seemed like a better education and experience for him there. So
she was also working part-time in Nashville?
She was, yeah. So the first 2 years, I was coming down here Monday through Wednesday.
Would you stay?
I would stay on somebody's couch or whatever and meet people at Losers, you know, and try to write songs. And then those first 2 years, I was down here pretty much without her and my boy. And I didn't get to see her very much those first 2 years. But, you know, after the publishing deal kind of happened and everything, we got to, you know, start coming down here together and more and stuff.
So let me get this straight. You would come down here, drive from Kentucky on a Monday. And Losers is the bar where you know, a lot of local shows, a lot of people, songwriters. You would try to meet someone there to write with over the next couple of days.
Yeah.
What if you didn't? What if you met no one? Would you drive back home?
Well, I had a buddy named Matt Cooper, who was the lead singer of this band called Borrow Blue. They were all friends of my wife, childhood friends. So his dad had a condo at the Terrazzo, and he had been coming down here for like 2 years already. So he knew some people. So first time I came down with him, or first, you know, few months I was coming down with him, staying there, yeah. and you know, writing with people that he already knew. But we were always at Losers every day after we were done.
When you would drive down, what was the goal for you? Was it to get a publishing deal as a writer, or was it to, okay, I'm going to get a publishing deal, but that's only so I can get my artist career up and running?
Yeah, I was kind of focused on the publishing deal at first. Like, I always want to sing, you know, my songs if I get a chance to. So I was booking myself bar gigs and stuff to make some money, which I wish I would have done a lot sooner, because I didn't realize I could, like, make more money than I was making cutting trees and shoveling corn, you know, selling T-shirts and playing 4 hours at a bar a night with acoustic guitar. But the hopes were to just get a pub deal and then, you know, see what came after that. My 5-year goals, which we just got to the end of my 5 years last year, and every 5 years, like, I write out, you know, 5 goals for those 5 years. And first was publishing deal, and I wanted to get outside cuts. I wanted to get a record deal, get a number one. I'm missing one. I can't remember. Oh, the first one was moved to Nashville. So, because I was still in Kentucky at the time. So, publishing deal was first, you know, and that's kind of like the order of things typically.
What do people in your town think? Because you have to be, you know, a bit of a hometown hero right now.
It's cool, man. It's kind of hard to go to Walmart sometimes, you know, but.
Well, you also have a very distinctive look. I mean, you can't really miss them, right, Mike?
You can't.
Yeah, and, you know, probably one of the only dudes in Monticello, Kentucky that's running around with 3 necklaces and earrings and, you know, wearing the stuff I do.
Yeah, I bet it's, you know, more of a fishbowl doing this and living where you live than if you were here and everybody did what you did and it's not as big of a deal here. Meaning I can go to the mall and have seen Keith Urban. You know, you can go to a restaurant and see Cole Swindell or Kip Moore at the grocery store. However, if you're in Eastern Kentucky and you're the one that's doing something big, like, everyone has to, like, take pictures of you and be like, "Hey, okay, he's out here."
I get to take pictures with a lot of folks, particularly at Walmart. But it's cool, man. You know, it's like that just means that they love what I'm doing and they support me. And I see Becky all the time. Me and her have took several pictures, and I'm like, "We took a picture last time, Becky." She's like, "I want a new one."
So. Is there a hometown radio station there?
Z93, 93.3, but that's the small town Monticello, and then there's 93.9, I believe, is in Somerset, and they do iHeartRadio, so your show's on in the mornings.
How far is Somerset from where you live?
16 miles.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah, it's not too far.
Whenever we first started here, I mean, now it's been almost 9 years, we came on the radio, and we were like yourself. We were very different from anybody else doing this, because I don't have a good voice. I don't wear a cowboy hat. I grew up in extremely rural Arkansas and, you know, have been so heavily influenced by country music, but also alternative music, also hip hop. And so, you know, we started doing this show, and this woman in Somerset would call every day and tell us how much we sucked every day. And she was like, "I will never listen to this show." And I said, and I would talk to her, put her on the air. I'd say, "Listen, I get it. You don't like us now, but if you'll just spend a couple weeks with us, and then if you hate us, I will drive to Somerset and I will give you $100. But you have to listen every day for at least, I think I said 20 minutes. If you listen 2 weeks every day for 20 minutes and you still call me and you go, 'I hate this show, this is an embarrassment, you are not what I like,' I will personally put the cash in my wallet and drive up there." And so she agreed. And we call her every day, 2 days, 3 days, hit the week mark. She really wasn't budging after a week. I felt like she was starting to crack after that second week a little bit. So we got her on the phone the last day after 2 weeks. And I said, "Well," and she goes, "Well, I still hate you." So I drove all the way to Somerset, gave her that money.
Oh, no. Did you go through Cookeville or Bowling Green?
I think we went through Bowling Green. And right outside of a Sonic there in Somerset, I gave her the cash. And I never saw her from her again. And so that's my relationship with Somerset, Kentucky.
Dang, man. Why do some people feel the need to tell you those things?
I don't know. At this point, I'm just kind of used to it. But
I would imagine. Yeah, I'm starting to get more and more of it. You know, I guess with more people or with more exposure, you find more haters.
But, yeah, I mean, I always compare it, and I don't know what people have to hate on you. You're a very authentic guy. But I've found, and I've also talked to new artists who suffer from this, that I imagine I'm standing on the ground, and there are, you know, people that can see me on the ground. But it's only the people that are close to me that can see me because I'm the same level that they are. But as the pedestal starts to lift, a few more people can see you because you're getting higher. The higher you go, just generally, the more people can see you. And the more people that can see you are the more people that can comment on you. You know, when you're down on the ground level, nobody's really saying anything bad about you because only a few people are seeing you. You haven't changed at all. You've just shot up the pedestal a little higher. So more people can see you from farther. And just because it's a numbers game and people want to have voices, people want to give their opinions even when it's not asked, that's when you start to get the, hey, you suck. Hey, do you ever get people talking, not that you suck, but going, hey, what's up with your image? Like what, you know?
I had this one dude on YouTube that was like, I love the song, but hate your sister's blue jeans, you know? And I was like saying, I was wearing my sister's blue jeans.
I was talking about your sister. Yeah. I was like, man, that's some deep hate.
I was like, well, dang, I thought I was in the wrong section of the day I bought those. But dude, I think he just wanted to reply because he ended up commenting back and he was, you know, he was friendly or whatever. So, and two, like sometimes, like I remember the first time, they say don't read the comments, right? But the first time that I really got pissed off, I had never seen the negative side to our song at all. It was all positive to me. But this guy, he commented something like, hey, you're just poaching some other dude's kid. You know, and I was like, I got pissed off. I was like, cool story, bro. You know, and then I deleted my comment as soon as I said it because I was like, I'm not going to be an ass because he's being one. And but he had enough time to see it. And then he posts pictures of my comment. So I'm like, all right, whatever. But I go back and I creep on his Facebook for a little while. And I noticed like 4 months before that, it was pictures of him and his little boy. Every picture was him and his little boy. And you could tell, like, he loves this kid, you know? And then all of a sudden it turned into, you know, haven't seen my boy in, you know, 3 weeks, baby's mama, got a new boyfriend, pizza, you know, whatever. And I was like, oh, I get it now, you know? So he was like, he didn't care about me. He don't even know me, you know? Right. I'm a nice guy. I'll be nice to anybody if they give me a chance. But then I was like, I kind of found some empathy through that. So it kind of gave me, you're not supposed to read comments, you're not supposed to comment back, but it kind of gave me ammunition for the future people who did that to just have a nicer approach and, you know, maybe kill them with kindness.
That's good that you learned a lesson from that because I would have just shot a couple bullets on the internet and tagged them and let everybody else see it and then ran away and let everybody take care of it for me. You know, but that's good for you for learning something. And dude, people do say don't look at the comments, but I think the ultimate goal is not to dwell on the comments and not to feel like you need to look at the comments every second of every day. I don't know anyone who doesn't look at the comments.
Yeah, it's weird, man. It's like it is like a drug. I mean, it really is. It's like instant gratification. You put a post, you post a song, you post a cool picture. People are like, oh, that's dope, whatever, you know, and you're like, oh, that feels good. But those feel equally as bad. It's like losing all your money at, you know, playing 21 or blackjack.
Now we're talking about something I relate to. What was growing up for you, your hometown was called what? It's called what?
Caneyville, Kentucky.
So what's Caneyville like?
10 years behind the rest of the world. It's a cool spot, man. I grew up in a little holler called Post Towsie. And, you know, it's just hardworking, blue-collar, American people, truck drivers, mechanics.
Yeah, what do most people do there? Drive trucks, work on trucks?
There's a trucking company called Majors there that's got quite a few trucks. I grew up around all the truck drivers because my dad was a truck driver, so it seemed like there was a lot of them to me, you know? And they're all, like, legends in my eyes. You got Legs and Pickle Man and JJ, and, you know, they call my dad Scratch. So all these guys had crazy names, and I'm this little kid running around chasing them and stuff, and they're all such characters. But then people like Tinker and Harold Higgs, they're mechanics. And I always just looked up to a lot of people that were in the automotive industry in some way. But they're also, you know, there used to be a bunch of factories, but they all moved to Mexico or Germany or something. So,
did you want to work in automotive or drive a truck?
I did. My first job in high school, I was in a co-op program. Leave school at 11 o'clock every day, go eat lunch, and then I went to a full-service gas station. It was Little Tinker, who's not a little guy at all. He's about 6'8", you know, 400-pound dude. Could probably throw this desk at you if he was mad enough, I know. But I went there every day and pumped gas, did oil changes, brake jobs, tires, stuff like that, and got pretty good with a gas pump where I could stop it on whatever number you wanted me to. Back when gas was $1.25, that was cool.
Did you ever think you wanted to drive?
Drive a truck?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've drove a truck, too. I drove a truck a couple times while we were, I think it was this last year, or what, during the quarantine.
Like a big truck?
Semi-truck, yeah.
You have a CDL?
I do not, no. I have had in the past.
Citizen's arrest, Mike. Citizen's arrest.
No, it's okay. Actually, in Kentucky, you can do 150 nautical miles if you have farm tags. So I was hauling grain. I think I went a little over 150 miles, but, you know, they didn't catch me, so.
Driving a truck, I had a show called Breaking Bobby Bones where I had to do things, and long story short, I had to go and get my CDL, drive all the way across Chattanooga with a load of eggs.
Class A or B or what?
Whatever the big one is.
Pulling a trailer?
Yeah.
Air brakes?
Yeah.
Yeah, Class A.
Had to study the air brakes and how to pass the test.
That pre-trip test is hell, ain't it?
Man, what sucks is everyone is not, they disregard you in the big truck when the big truck could kill them. Mm-hmm. Like they're all over the place. They don't care. They're cutting you off. It's like, I'm in this massive truck. And if one little thing goes wrong, somebody's going to die. Yet everybody's all around me darting in and out, you know, giving no care at all.
80,000 pounds don't stop that quick, man.
At all.
And I mean, I've seen some wild stuff. I've spent my entire life on the road and you know, in some capacity, and just being out on the road with my dad when I was a kid and everything. I've literally seen a semi-truck go over the top of an F-150, like crew cab pickup truck, like because things got messed up. And, you know, you would think in this big four-wheel drive truck that you're like, you're up high enough that a semi-truck ain't going to go over top of you.
Right.
It will.
What'd your dad say about that? He wants you to be a truck driver? Was he encouraging to you to try to be creative and do music?
If you listen to a song called Miles on the record, it's the last song on the record, there's a string intro that was kind of a tip of the hat to Mac Miller. But in the end of that string intro, you can hear my dad say, boy, you better learn something or you're going to be working out here on this hot-ass gravel on a truck all your life. And I think my dad would have definitely been fine with me being a truck driver. I know he would because my younger brother now owns a trucking company. He's 26. He just bought two trucks, two trailers, and put my dad back on the road, and they're running up and down the road together and having a blast. But I just he always pushed me so hard to, like, do good in school, which I didn't do, but I got by. But mostly because he was keeping me up till 4 o'clock in the morning working on his trucks. You know, it's like every freaking weekend during the week, man. He had like three or four trucks, and we were always broke. So as you know, I was cheap labor. I could do everything he needed done, or help him do everything he needed done for $5 an hour, or a carton of cigarettes. You know,
so you can work on a car pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a language that you know really well.
I've always looked at, ever since I was young, I've always looked at it as if someone always has done it first. So, like, if it's already put together, I can take it apart and put it back together with new parts. But, you know, there's a trick in the country, shade tree mechanic, and you always have to have leftover parts at the end or you didn't do it right, you know, so.
When you were growing up in Caneyville, right? Mm-hmm. Caneyville. How big was the school? Like, what was that like?
It was big. So we had four K-12 schools in my county that consolidated in 76 or 77. So we had a 6A high school.
Wow.
There was a lot of, it was a big county, all very rural. The most urban part of my county would be Litchfield, Kentucky. But I don't know. Have any idea what the population is there or anything, but it was like the city. That's where you went to Walmart, to the grocery, to restaurants, whatever. But yeah, there's a lot of kids, man, and that rivalry between communities was still very alive and well. It's like you made friends from different areas, but there was fights all the time, and it was just, you know, that's just how it was.
What about school? Like, I guess what at school did you like and were you drawn to?
I liked music, obviously. I was in a chorus program from fourth grade till ninth grade. Actually, one of my principals and a teacher that just took a liking to me kind of started this first chorus program to help get me out of trouble a little bit. And so kudos to them, Mr. Huffman, and at the time, Miss Childress. But I liked that. I liked automotive stuff, obviously. I liked English. I didn't do great in English class, but I enjoyed the stories. I was just kind of ornery, man. I just didn't do my work.
But could you sing before chorus, or did chorus actually tell you that you could sing?
So my mom can sing really well. My dad could sing really well. All my siblings sing. I was singing well before I even went to school. We were just going to church and, you know, old school, traditional, you know, Baptist church, singing hymns and stuff. So I was always just trying to mimic my mom and this guy named Ron Spurgeon, who was a preacher and a tenor singer in a group called Journeyman and Jan. And he could get up there where the money was, you know. And so I loved to, like, try to sing high and everything, like my mom and like him. And then, you know, John Fogerty was a big influence for my dad, and Steve Earle as well. So I don't know. I kind of knew I was a singer, you know, well before that.
In school, in chorus, were you like one of the better singers, or was it later that you kind of found your voice?
Oh, man, I don't like to say I'm better at anything. I got a lot of solos, put it that way. One my mom missed. I remember that. But no, I was just pick on her. She hates that. She went to the bathroom, man, and I had the beginning of Auld Lang Syne. And I was like, I could have waited, you know, but I didn't know that at the time. I'm in like seventh or eighth grade. I'm like, I can't. The show must go on. Sorry, Mom. But got a lot of solos. My first, the first show we did with the fourth grade was a Christmas tree lighting in my hometown at the bank, and I sang part of Winter Wonderland. In the meadow, we build snowman. You know, whatever that part is. Parson Brown.
Yeah, it's a fella I know. Yeah. So, were you also wanting to be a singer as a career when you were a kid, or was it something you were just doing for fun, but you kind of, because I'm from a town like yours where nobody really did anything other than what everybody was already doing.
Dude, it just seemed so far out of reach. I didn't know that you could, like, come to Nashville and go hang out at bars and meet talented people and write songs with them, or I would have been here the day after I graduated high school. It just all seemed like such a process that was impossible for somebody like me from where I was from. I kind of grew up in a yeah right town, if you will, similar to you. I was in a band in high school. We did like punk and, you know, hard rock stuff. And
cover stuff or original stuff?
Original stuff. Actually, I met the bass player at a revival one night. My mom let me go to a different denominational, or I think she came too, which was really odd. We went to a different denomination's revival one night, and I was singing hymns, and this guy came up to me afterward, and he was like, hey, man, our singer in our band just quit, and we got a gig at the VFW in Danville, Kentucky next Saturday. Can you sing in our band? So I asked my mom, and to my surprise, she said yes, and I went and learned, like, all their originals that week, and we went up there and did the show, and I was like, man, this is a lot of fun, you know? So that kind of started the whole thing, but I played in college.
Did you sing in church? You're talking about you and your mom going to a revival.
Yeah.
I know you mentioned, but, I mean, were you, like, one of the singers at church when it was time? Were you the guy?
Yeah, the whole congregation kind of sang or tried to, regardless. Everybody.
Made a joyful noise? Everybody
made a joyful noise. Sometimes not so joyful, but yeah, I would say, like, my mom, me, my mama on my dad's side, because my mom went to church with all my dad's family. My dad, he didn't ever show up, you know. But there was quite a few singers at church. I was exposed to a lot of talented singers and musicians. My aunts played piano, but would never teach me, probably because I was so ADD. They just didn't want to deal with it, you know.
When you finish high school, you go to college. Where'd you go to school?
I went to the School of Hard Knocks, man. I moved to Red Bull in Springs, Tennessee for 2 years, where the pastor of my church lived. He would drive like 2 hours on Sundays and Wednesday nights to pastor our church. And I went to work for him doing mobile home warranty work all over the East Coast.
You just said college.
Yeah, well, I was like, in the School of Hard Knocks. Yeah, I didn't go to college.
Okay, but I did. But you just okay.
I did, was but later on.
Oh, you did later on.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay, so you had a couple gap years. It sounds like.
Yeah, I went 2 years as a mobile home warranty worker and driver, and I was very heavily involved in the church, and then I came back home and did a 180, went to college in Bowling Green for a couple years, did really good, and then started doing really bad.
What was the pivot point there from doing really good to really bad?
Weed, yeah.
All at once? Or yeah. Did you do really good, then the next day you go, that really bad, or was it a slow evolution?
I think it was a slow evolution. I started letting new things be introduced into my life and at, you know, greater quantities. And, I did good there for 2 years. I think I was on the dean's list 4.0, you know, for at least two or three semesters. And I was like, I'm going to be the first person from my family to go to a 4-year college and like make something happen. And I was so excited. And it was so much fun. I was going for creative writing and English literature. I wanted to I thought I was going to be a college professor or something. And that lifestyle just looks so romantic in movies and stuff, you know? But then I was like, man, I just hate doing all this work that everybody else wants me to do. I just want to do what I want to do, you know? But
Were you playing music, your own music in college at all?
I was in a group called 88 with my buddy Seth Stewart and Chad Lindsay, or Brillo, we call him. He played guitar. My buddy Seth played bass. I played guitar and sang, and we were just three-piece. We were called 88 because we were all born in 88, and we rehearsed in our hometown at a garage at our buddy Patty's house on Highway 88. So it's just like, hey, that all makes sense. And we got our logo. My buddy Chad.
On your shoulder, your right shoulder.
Yeah.
And so with 88, was there hope of we're going to turn this into something, or was it more of this is what we're doing as something that we can get together and have fun?
Yeah, it was just have fun and, you know.
Were you guys good?
Free beer, no. We were probably not very good. But we had a lot of fun and we had a lot of friends come to see us. So we had like super cheap equipment that sounded clanky and, you know, I hate to be like that, but more expensive guitars just sound better, you know? But also you learn how to play them better, yeah. You know, too.
What was the deal with you guys deciding not to be a band anymore?
Oh, man, I don't know. That was a very chaotic time in my life. Like, I think that we just kind of all started fading out and going our separate ways. Seth moved to Louisville with a girl. Chad moved to Nashville with girls.
Did you think, though, when you were I'm assuming you were fronting the band. Were you the lead singer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you think as you were doing this, and you're a little more adult now, and regardless of what other decisions you were making, did you think, hey, I can actually do this?
No, I still didn't have that kind of confidence. I feel like I've always felt like, you know, God gave me a talent with my voice, and I always felt like I said things in a different way, and I like to write. Like, I had some poems and stuff that won some competitions at Western, and my sister was a poet and had some published poems and stuff too, which, but I just still, I don't know, man, it's so embedded in me where I come from. It's like, you know, it's just growing up a little poor and, you know, everything seems so out of, you grow up broke, it never leaves you, you know? So it's like everything just seemed like it was impossible. And it wasn't until I watched a Steve Harvey video on YouTube, and he was talking about jump, like just jump, and eventually your parachute's got to come out. And so that kind of got me into trying to do something with music.
So you see this video, because there have been things in my life too that I've seen, and they've inspired me to take chances, especially early on. Because like you, I'm from a town of 700 people in Arkansas. So nobody ever did anything I wanted to do, so it didn't seem real.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't see somebody doing it, it's just something on TV that rich people or fancy people
do. That's not a job. Yeah. That's not work, yeah.
And so you're watching this video of Steve Harvey saying jump. But what did that say to you? Was it jump into music? Was it jump into getting out of this town? Like, what did that mean to you?
I think it was jump into music. There's a lot of things. I'm sure where you're at now, there's a lot of things like that video for you. One of the other things for me was my father-in-law told me one day I needed to find my niche, and I was cutting trees for him when he said it, you know. I've had somebody tell me, set the expectation when you start working with somebody, and that's something that I've held on to. But it was that video, watching that video just, I don't know, man, I was just at a breaking point. Like, I've never been a big drinker. I've been enjoying a little bourbon here lately, but I had to go through these phases. But I was, like, going and sitting out on the porch and just drinking Fireball and, like, looking up into the sky, just, like, miserable. Crying, grown-ass man. And it was just, like, miserable with, not with who I was with or the people I was around. I had good friends and everything, but I was just like, man, there's got to be something more out there. And some people don't want more, and that's cool, but I wanted more. And that video was just like, it said, you know, if you jump, eventually your parachute's going to come out, you know? And it was always like a financial hang-up for me. Like, how am I going to afford, especially now that I'm married, I have a kid, how am I going to afford to chase my dreams and do music? Somebody's got some.
Yeah, grab water.
Mm-hmm. How am I going to afford to chase my dreams and do music and then be a provider or an assistance to my providing for my family? And it was cool, man. Like, when I watched that video, and, you know, later on down the road, I just realized that if you kind of follow what that calling is, that I think everybody has one, you know, yours being the radio, mine being writing songs and singing them, or, you know, this guy being a welder. If you follow that, however hard it is to get into it, there's like these angels that'll show up and give you a little bit of gas money for the road. You know, people who have been successful and know what that road is like, and they see you. Thank you, sir. So for me, it was like there was a couple of people that came along just when times were super hard, and they were like, put that in your pocket, you know, and that got me through the next month or something, you know. Or I would get a phone call from somebody that was like, hey, come play the show, and I'll pay you $2,000 to come play on my houseboat this weekend. I'm like, what? Really? Just to sing songs? Hell, I'll do that for $100, you know.
That's bad negotiation, but fair. So to be inspired by something, what was the first step you made that was a bit out of your comfort zone? What was the first chance for your parachute to open?
I would say I was working construction. I was in Coleman, Alabama, and I was shoveling gravel in a pipeline ditch. I had this foreman named Steve Rich, and he was just a good dude. And I'd brought my guitar a couple times, and he wanted me to play songs for him and stuff. And he kept telling me, hey, man, you need to do something. Well, I got tired of that job. I didn't like the people who were over Steve, and they made it clear they didn't like me either, but wouldn't fire me. So I left, and I went to my buddy Brandon's dad, Danny Davis, at this company called Pro Video Audio Productions. That's in my wife's little hometown. But they do, like, Tomcat Truss Systems, lights, sound. They do these festivals around Kentucky and the greater area of Kentucky. And I was just like, hey, man, I just want to be around music. I got, you know, willing hands and, you know, semi-strong back. And he said, we'll be here in 2 weeks. And I started throwing subs and speakers and lights and trailers and going out. And then one night at a show, our monitor tech didn't, like, show up when he was supposed to. And I had to just, like, jump on board. And so that was, like, the first time is, like, somebody – I did good that night. So they let me continue to do more, and I'd only ever worked with my hands, and they let me work with my mind and my hands for once, and it was so rewarding. And it was cool, too, now, because I can go to a show, and if I'm working with a monitor tech or something, I'll be like, hey, man, pull a little 500 out of my vocal or my guitar. And they always, first, they look at me like, who's this idiot trying to tell me he knows what frequencies? And I'm like, pull up the freaking frequency test right now. Let's go. But it helps out. It helps out a lot out on the road. But that was definitely Pro Video Audio Productions was the first parachute. And then, I don't know, I'll go on forever, man.
But when was it, too, and have some more water here, because it's so cold and snowy outside that we turned the heat up to 10,000, and now we're all sweating our balls off. There's a fine line. It was freezing in here. But hey, shout out to the heating system. It's pretty good. When was the performance parachute pulled?
The performance.
Like the person you are now, as far as the singer-songwriter, when was the first big risk or the first shot that you got? And you're like, okay, I think I'm going to pursue this. I'm going to go start playing these shows and make the decision to go play a show and make less money than possibly go and work, you know, your day-to-day job.
I mean, nothing ever really happened abruptly. It's all been kind of such a process. But I would say the big turning point in getting me to knuckle down and do this, my buddy Matt that I told you about earlier had been trying to get me to come to Nashville, and I was just like,
Why was he trying to get you to move to Nashville?
He didn't want me.
Did he know you could sing?
He wanted me to come down here and write. He believed in me, and he still does. But he just wanted me to come down there and start writing with people. And I was like, man, I just don't know. I was listening to Steel Drivers and Sturgill Simpson and the Johnson Brothers, a lot of Chris Stapleton stuff, a lot of Eric Church stuff. And during that time, there was this sound that was prevalent in country music, and it seemed like everybody was trying to do this sound. And I was like, man, I don't know that I have a place down there, you know? And then the CMA performance, what year was it, 2015, 16? When
Stapleton 15, and Timberlake?
Stapleton and Timberlake, man. That was a huge moment. I think not only just for me, but just for our genre, that was a huge moment because you had such diversity on the stage together. You had polar opposites almost, but it created something so cool. And I think since then we've seen our genre become so open to so many different sounds and takes on whatever. You can be Dan and Shay, or you can be Riley Green. You know, it's so right after that performance, my phone rings and it's Matt, and he's like, "Hey, yo, buddy, you reckon it's time to go to Nashville now?" And I said, dude, there might have been some doors just open. So the following Monday was my first time down here. And
so what was your expectation of coming down here versus the reality of what you got here?
Oh, man, it was awesome. Like I was like a kid in a candy store when it came down the first time. I was just like, I hadn't seen Nashville in so long. So my first, like, well, I came over the hill and was like, what in the hell has happened to Nashville? It's huge. But it was like I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, man, for a long time, and still feel that way from time to time. But you know, there's been some years wear on that.
How do you meet people though? Let's say your first time in Nashville. Like, what do you walk around the grocery store and be like, "All right, I need some lettuce and a friend to write with." Like, what do you do?
Well, Matt helped out. He introduced me to a buddy, his name Nick Columbia, who ended up being a writer on My Boy later on. So it was like my first friend in Nashville. And then from there, just going to Losers every day. And it's like, it sounds funny, like going to a bar, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and staying till two. But I did that for the first 3 months I was in town and ended up meeting just about everybody that I met everybody that I wrote My Boy with there for sure. And that song's been the biggest driving force in mine and their careers at this point. But yeah, I'm kind of I seem very extroverted, but I'm pretty introverted. I like to be by myself or be at home a lot, but when put in a situation, I can be the chameleon that I need to be. I enjoy like having a good time with people. It's just that if I prefer, I'd like to be at the cabin, you know, in the mountains. But
so you're going to the bar, but you're going to the bar to actually network. Were you at the bar drinking a lot, or were you at the bar meeting a lot?
I was doing a little bit of both. It sometimes was a lot of drinking. Sometimes was a lot of meeting. It got to be a lot of drinking for a while. And I told somebody this story here a while back, but the guy who owns Losers, I don't know if he just did this for everybody, but it seemed like he liked me and my buddy, and he would always like buy me a shot when he seen me if he was there. And then I went back a little while later, and you know, I hadn't been there in quite a while, and he said, "Man, I ain't seen you around here for a while." And I said, "Yeah, man, I'm sorry, I've just been, you know, keeping my nose down and trying to write." And he said, "That's good." You know, and I always look back on that. It's such a, you know, small moment, but I just thought it was cool that the guy that owned the bar was just like, recognized that, hey, this is a good place to be for certain things, but, you know, you don't need to be here all the time either. So
when did you start to get a little traction here? Not as a successful artist, but as okay, I'm going to write. And then you start writing, and I guess people started noticing your songs as you got a you know, a pub deal here?
I started just going around and singing My Boy at a lot of writers' rounds and some other songs that I had at the time. And I met a few people, Lisa Johnson and R.J. Romeo and Lance Roberts. That was like my original team. And Lisa knew a lot of people in the publishing world. RJ and Romeo Entertainment Group, they do a lot of fairs and festivals all over the United States. And then Lance Roberts was with United Talent Agency. And they just started kind of taking me around and introducing me to their friends. And I just, man, it was so cool, too, to because you have this idea of what it's like and what people are like in the industry. And it seems like everybody's all, you know, proper and everything. There's a bunch of freaking, you know, just regular country people and, you know, city folks. It's a melting pot, but it's good people. And I had that same idea about radio going into it, like that nervousness of like, what are these people going to be like? Are they uptight, whatever? And it's been a good experience there too.
You had a goal of getting an outside cut. Did you get an outside cut?
Man, I've had a couple, not on any major artists or anything yet. I would love to one day get one on an artist. You know, that especially an artist that I really enjoy listening to myself. But it's just as cool to just have somebody be like, you know, anybody be like, man, I love that song enough, I want to cut it. That's a pretty awesome feeling.
When did you get management starting to either take meetings with you or agree to come listen to you? How did that work out?
It's a cool story. We did everything up to recording the County Roads EP without any management. I had my team, you know, so I had like my brain trust of my group of people who were smarter than me and knew what was going on. But when I went to meet with John Loba, who's the head of my record label group, and play him the songs, I was like, hey, man, I think it's time for manager. And I said, why don't you call Al Dean's guy? And he just started laughing. He's like, hey, man, you know, Clarence ain't signing no new artists. And I was like, well, he's a Kentucky boy. I mean, you could at least send him a freaking email, you know? And so John's like, all right, dude, I'll send it over. Well, Clarence emails me like a few hours later. It just says, hey, this is Clarence. Call me tomorrow at 1 o'clock and left me a phone number. And I was like, to the point. I call him the next day and he said, hey, I told John Loba I ain't signing no more baby acts. And I was like, well, this is going good, you know? And he said, he sent me a few of your songs. You want to come over here and hang out tomorrow for a little bit? I went over there and talked to him. And I gave him a list of people that I was interested in working with, maybe 10 or 12 people. And he helped me narrow that down to like 4 or 5 people. And was like, hey, man, I think any of these people would make a great manager for you. But if you decided to come over here, and I was like, well, what do you mean? What's that mean? You know, he just said it so quick. And a couple of weeks, literally the next day is when they were like, everybody go home, don't go anywhere, you know? So
because of COVID.
COVID, yeah. The next day. So 2 weeks later, he calls me just chit-chatting. And the next day I call him. I'm like, hey, man, I don't quite see how anybody's going to understand my hillbilly ass. Like somebody from the same place, what do you say? We jump in the water together. And we did. And then he paired me up with a guy named Brian Wolf over there at Maverick. And it's just been awesome ever since, man. Those guys have created so many opportunities for me. And they're just good, hardworking people that whole team is.
Yeah, Clarence, I'm pretty close to Clarence. But and you, it's funny that you mention Al Dean, but it's like Reba.
Yeah.
Brooks and Dunn.
Yeah.
Al Dean.
Somebody screwed up the paperwork, man. I don't know how I got into that camp, but
it's a lot of massive Darius. You know, it's a lot of massive acts. He does he's the best.
It helps to hold me accountable. Like I know that nobody. Well, I know how hard everybody there works, and I know that they're not going to put up with no bull crap, especially from some little baby artist like me that's just showing up on the scene, you know? So it definitely holds me accountable, and I want anybody that I interact with or work with to be proud of what I'm giving to that relationship. So it ain't always the case, but I try.
You say you grew up listening to a lot of 90s country in the car with maybe your mom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who are the artists that you listen to? They're like, man, like I love that artist and what they say.
Man, I liked a lot of Dwight Yoakam, a lot of Clint Black, Garth Brooks, you know, Tim McGraw when he was getting started. I don't know what years was that when Tim was first getting started. Was that later 90s?
I mean, It's weird that Tim McGraw was even in the 90s, I'll be honest with you, because he's still today.
Oh, it's crazy.
And a lot of those acts from the 90s are considered legacy acts now, but McGraw has never turned legacy.
Yeah, McGraw's a badass, man. He's been going for a long time.
I would assume like 93, 94, though.
Really?
I mean...
Yeah, 93, 94.
Yeah.
Indian Outlaw was 94.
Wow.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I remember listening, you know, Little Rock was an hour away. It was the big city. But I remember listening to Kiss of 96 and Indian Outlaw, then Don't Take the Girl. And I was, you know, 13, 14 years old.
That's wild, man. Yeah, he's definitely stayed relevant and you know, had so many changes in his life. And he's like... I was watching 1883 the other day, and I was just like, man, I hope I'm half as bad as this dude is when I'm his age and have achieved what he has, you know, and still, you know, with his family and, you know, I'm sure they've had their trials and tribulations, but like everything seems very strong at the surface anyway.
What about classic rock influence?
Oh, dude, there's a lot. I mean, Southern rock, classic rock, heartland rock for the most, I love like Tom Petty, Mellencamp. I kind of put Steve Earle in that world. He's kind of country.
He's a hybrid. Yeah, I would say he's hybrid there.
You know, obviously there was a lot of Southern rock influence to Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Allman Brothers, the Band. My dad listened to that stuff predominantly, and I would like in the mornings if you listen to a song on my record called "Sundays in the South." Is literally how my Sundays went. In the mornings on the way to church, we'd go to the gas station, get a Yoo-Hoo, listen to you know country, 90s country. Then after church, the NASCAR race would be on. I get home, dad would be working on, you know, something out in the driveway, a car, truck, semi, and be playing, you know, I think it's 103.7 The Point. It was like classic Southern rock up in Bowling Green, and that was the station he usually had it on there.
I mean, that's what I grew up on, too, was listening. For me, it was cool 95, but my stepdad would always, it was classic rock all the time. And I knew that as well as I knew anything else, if it was country or, you know, alternative at the time. But we were together at Christmas a little bit because him and I still have a relationship. And we were listening to the classic rock station. And we used to play this game when I was like 13 where you'd be like, all right, who's the band? And I would go, that's BTO, that name the year. You know, it was just something that we did that kind of brought us together. It was sports and music. And we were together in his truck and we were going to eat. And we were listening to the station. And it was like we started doing it again. You know, and here we are so many years later.
Still got it?
Nope. Oh. No, I've lost a little bit of it because I'm not as quick. But it's just funny how it puts you back in that time again. Just hearing those songs again, sitting beside him in the truck as he was driving again. I almost felt 13 or 14 years old again.
Yeah, it is really cool how music can do that. For me, the Blue Moon Swamp record from 97, John Fogerty's solo record, and the Guitar Town record. Those two records are when I'm riding around my hometown, you know, every now and then I still got to get out and do what teenage LV did, you know, ride around my circle and listen to those records. And it really will. Music can really take you back and make you, because, I mean, there's nothing different except for what the inside of the car looks like these days when you're out doing that, riding around listening to that same music.
It's funny, keep referencing John Fogerty. I'm a massive John Fogerty fan, big Creedence fan. And so that's the first concert I ever bought a ticket to myself, because my first concert was Diamond Rio, and church took us, so I didn't pay for that. But the first concert ever drove to and bought a ticket to myself was John Fogerty in Little Rock.
I bet that was awesome.
And it was because of my stepdad, who was a massive Creedence Clearwater fan.
Was this before or after he started playing his old CCR songs again? Because there was a point in time where I guess he couldn't really play his own stuff.
And he sued himself. He sued his own band. he had to sue himself, basically.
I started reading his bio, and it was tough. I had to quit reading it because it was just there's just a lot of and I don't know. It's just the dude's been through the ringer. You know, he had a hard time.
And his brother was in the band.
Yeah,
you know, they were both in CCR. They played some CCR stuff, but he was playing center field. He was playing a lot of his new stuff too. But I was a big John Fogerty fan. I guess still am. I heard he's getting pretty up there. He's getting pretty old now.
Yeah, I would love to. They say never meet your heroes, but Steve Earle definitely didn't disappoint. He's became somewhat of a fan,
really?
Or a friend, not fan friend. I hope he's a fan. I've met him. I met him a couple times. Got to see him inducted into the Country Music Writers Hall of Fame here a while back. That was so awesome. Emmylou Harris came out and sang Pilgrim. It was so sick. But got to write with him one time, me, him, and
wow.
Dylan. Yeah,
how intimidating
awesome.
Is that?
Oh, man. I mean, I was pumped. I wasn't, I guess I wasn't like nervous or scared or anything, but I was just so excited. I wanted to get something great. And what was really cool is I feel like this guy's been writing my life, my whole life anyway, but we didn't finish the song. And then he sent me a second verse, and it was like something about a little boy and a little girl on the way, and then something about driving these county roads. And I was like, dude, that, I was like, and but he's like an encyclopedia, man. It's so cool to talk to him or write with him, because for 20 minutes you'll talk about, you know, music history or culture history or something that, you know, that Steve's interested in, and then you write for a couple minutes and then you talk about stuff again. So get an education.
That's
with
pretty
him.
Cool. You get to write with him.
Yeah, man. I'm cool. Looking forward to doing it again. We were supposed to do it the second 2 days ago, and I ended up having, like, I got COVID back before Christmas, and then I guess somebody in their camp got COVID, and he just didn't want to, you know, risk it. So,
whenever you cut My Boy, did you have that song recorded before you got a record deal? Because I know you started talking about singing it. Is that what kind of got you a deal, that song?
That song is exactly what got me a deal. John and Carson over at the label, they say that's the only reason they signed me. And I thought I had a whole record at the time. But shortly after signing, they were like, we feel like you only got one song. I'm like, I feel like you're full of shit. But they were right. But no, I recorded that song several times, man. I got a really good, like, advance sign-on bonus for my first publishing deal. And I spent every bit of that money on recordings for My Boy. The recording that you guys played on the radio was, I think, the 7th or 8th version of that song.
Why'd you keep recording it?
It just wasn't right, man. And it just didn't make me feel like it felt when I played it acoustic. And the second to last time, I didn't really like it. My producer was pumped about it. It was cool, you know, it was vibey and cool, but I went and played it. I picked up John Loba at the label and was like, hey, man, I got these first three songs done. Let's go ride around in my Mustang and listen. And we're coming down Music Row, and he's listened to, I think, County Roads and My Mississippi or no, County Roads and Saturday Night Me. And we get to My Boy, and I'm watching him, and he's just kind of like, and the song goes off, and he's like, man, I think I'm in demo love. And I, like, curbed my car and was like, get the out of my car, man. He's like, what do you mean? I said, no, I'm just kidding. I said, I feel the same way, dude. And I said, he said, you know, he just looked at me and was like, you know if it's right, man. Go in the studio and make it right. And I fought and fought and fought with people in the recording process about it being acoustic in the beginning. And everybody's like, it ain't going to work at radio. It ain't going to work at radio. And I was like, I don't care. I got to feel what I feel. You know, regardless of what radio is going to do with this song, it's going to relate to people. They got to feel it right. And so Lee Starr, who's another writer on the song, came in and had this guitar part. And I said, dude, just go in there and record it. You know, and this was weeks after we had cut it with the studio band. So that was like the 8th recording. And then we ended up going and doing the My Girl version too. So
did you feel like the song wasn't going to hit ever? Like, was there a time or a couple of times where it stalled and you're like, I don't, man, thought we had it, but we don't?
Yeah, man, there's been like so many, there goes my 15 minutes of fame. It blew up on Facebook the year before I signed my record deal, which led to, you know, it getting some attention around town and helped with the record deal. But it was 6 million views in like 2 weeks. The only thing I'd ever put on the internet that went over a few thousand views. So I'm all excited. We're all excited. And then Facebook just pulls the video. And we're like, we're reaching out to them. My booking agents, we're like, what happened? No answer. So there was nothing. It was still going up like 100,000 views an hour. It was just really starting to take off. So then I was like, well, hell, that sucks. Well, then I signed my deal. And the last thing you want to do when you sign a record deal is be the guy that gets shelved, you know? But I'm so thankful for that at this point. I didn't get shelved. They just said, you know, you don't have it all put together yet. You have this one thing. And as much as I disagreed in the beginning, like, they were so right. And there's not a single song off this record that was written before my record deal except for My Boy. And but I don't know, man. The process was just, it was crazy. I didn't really find myself until after signing my record deal.
When that thing starts to be top 10 or so, I mean, did it start to feel like, man, we have a, not only a monster like that's affecting people, but I mean, this thing is actually like really gaining traction commercially.
It was cool. I opted out of the emails every week and everything. Like, I didn't want to be the
like chart emails telling you where it went up and down.
I was like, just let the song do what it's going to do. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to go out here. I'm going to be good to people. I'm going to meet people at radio when we get a chance because we're having to do all this weird stuff. But when it got to top 10, we're looking at the charts and it's like, man, like steady chart flow. It looks like we're going to be good to go. And then what do you know? Here comes Jason Aldean and Carrie Underwood. And then here comes Maren and Ryan. And then here comes Walker Hayes. And I'm just like, Jesus Christ. What is going on, man? Like, there's three huge songs that are just, and then I mean, the Walker Hayes thing, that was crazy. But I've been a fan of Walker's for a while. He's always been really different. And one of my favorite songs is that Halloween song of his.
Mm-hmm. Him and Nicole Galyon sing that together. Yeah,
so sick. Such a really cool song. If you're watching this, you haven't heard it, go check it out. But I saw Walker right when all that stuff was going on. We played golf and guitars or something over in Oregon. And I was just like, dude, I don't know you really, but I just want to, you know, let you know I'm proud of you. I've seen and heard of you grinding for years. And I know some people in his camp and stuff. But then, you know, Aldean, you know, he's my label mate, my management mate, everything. I'm just like, Jesus, is this going to hurt me or help me?
You got it, though. You rang the bell.
We got it, man. We got it. And yeah, it's just, it was a cool win. It was, for me, man, the thought of me having a number one, I was like, hell yeah, that's awesome. But I just wanted to see the song win. I didn't care who was singing. It was just like, I wanted, and not to be down on it, but everybody knows how it all works. And like, sometimes those songs, they just don't make it. They don't cut through the noise. And I was just going to be so disappointed if that song didn't get its spot. And I felt like the years and the faith that I've had in it, my co-writers, my team, I was like, I just didn't want to see it fail. So thanks, everybody, for not letting us fail.
What's the next single? You guys have, is it announced yet?
We haven't announced it, but I'll tell you.
I mean, you don't have to if you don't want to. I didn't know.
Well, I'll put it this way. I talk a lot about the road in my life in general, and we are going to try to get some people some speeding tickets over the next, hopefully, let's cut it down to, can we cut it down to 20 weeks this time? Like,
Listen, you're really asking for a
come
gift
on, man.
If you want to do it at 20 weeks.
Come on, man. Do we got to go a whole year this time?
Let's see. Country Roads?
Oh, you did it. All right, let's fight. Somebody go get some gloves.
I mean, no. We're not saying this is it, but here, Mike.
I know you've practiced boxing, but listen to this really close. County roads. Everybody says country roads, and I'm like, dude, John Denver had that one covered.
I said country roads too.
You did.
Wow, that's crazy.
It's a marketing nightmare. You guys get it right. Come on, county roads.
I'm literally looking right at it and said country roads.
Yeah, I get it, man. I mean, it's country music. You see, the R doesn't really stick out to you.
That's wild.
And even that, like, people will literally listen to it, and the last word is county roads.
And they still go country
roads. And they're like, man, that was Country Roads by Elvis Chain. County.
Yeah, county. I won't mess that up again. But I mean, I'm looking right at it and still said it. So there's something to that. We've been talking about country music. Like, it's in my brain to say country roads.
Yeah, and we could have said country roads, but that just seemed too cliche to me. Yeah. County roads seemed more relatable.
Also,
and,
you don't want to name it Country Roads. You might as well.
It's John Denver, man.
You might as well name a song Boy Named Sue. You know, you got to stay away from the classic name.
John Denver. Dude, one of my favorite stories in country music, I think it was a CMA Awards, Charlie Rich.
He opens it up and John Denver.
My friend John Denver.
Lights it on fire.
Yeah, I want to get a tattoo of him doing that so bad. I thought that was so baller.
Let me mention this because I want to get a little promo here for you too.
Come on.
My Kind of Trouble Tour. You're doing shows starting in February, so next month. You and Frank Ray are on the road, right?
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, of country and county, I bet people call you Elvis or Elva. Like, I bet you that's mixed up too a lot, right?
LB. Yeah. People think I say LB. I don't know if it's just because of my accent or whatever. But LB, Elvi, Elvis. I get all of them.
I get Bobby Jones a lot.
Bobby Jones.
I was doing. I hosted the New Year's Eve show on CBS like a few days ago, and on the bowl games that morning, Brad Nessler's, you know, in the middle of the game. All right, be sure to watch tonight. Bobby Jones hosts this. I mean, it happens all the time. So I'm imagining with a name.
And your real last name's Esther, is that right?
See, that's a mess up too. It's E-S-T-E-L-L.
Oh.
How would you say it?
E-S-T-E-L-L?
Right.
Estelle.
See, and this is the debate my wife and I have because she likes for it to be said Estelle.
Uh-huh.
So she says it that way because that's how it's spelled. But where I'm from, in Arkansas.
Estelle.
It's Estelle.
Yeah. It's definitely Estelle in Caneyville too.
It is funny that you said Estelle because that's how it is. That's what my family always called it. So lvshane.com, all the dates are up there. Everywhere from Chattanooga to Charlotte. I'm just going to read down them. Greenville, Indianapolis, Louisville, Cincinnati, Lexington, Warrendale, Pennsylvania, Chicago, Springfield, Little Rock, Birmingham, Macon, and Nashville, Tennessee. So you're going to go out and do a bunch of shows, which is pretty exciting.
Man, I'm pumped. And we're adding everybody likes to compare me to church all the time anyway. So I got me a real genuine Joanna Cotton coming out on the road with us for some of these. It's not actually her, but Jenna McClellan, who sang backgrounds on Saturday Night Me on the record. She just, it's hard to find somebody to sing harmonies with me, man. I guess tenor range or whatever. And she's going to bring some really cool energy to the stage with the Broken Arrows, my band. And I'm just so pumped to get out there and do this hard ticket thing, man. I want to build this firm
foundation. That's a test. The hard ticket. That's the test.
It's okay, man. If it doesn't go great this time, then we'll just keep going, man. I've got faith in my band. I've got faith in my co-writers and everything to get this stuff out there and get people latched on. So,
all right, let's go to Reed for one question. All right, Reed. At the beginning of this, you talk about how I put you on the spot. What's your one question for LV Shane?
Okay. Let's see.
Take a deep breath, Reed.
All right. I didn't drink coffee this time.
Oh, Lord.
I'm a little bit better. All right, here we go.
Eventually, Mike, he's gonna know I'm gonna come to him, right?
Because I
know you would think.
Because he lives flustered. Go ahead, Reed.
Well, the thing with Keith Urban, my dad was listening to it, and he was like, "You went that whole time, and you did not even ask a question. You just talked about random stuff." So I'm gonna ask a question this time.
Go ahead.
When you write music, are you more of a lyrics first guy or melody guy first, or does it depend?
Man, I think it's different. It's different all the time. I definitely know how I say things, so sometimes there's someone who's on fire in the room with lyrics, and and I just try to adjust the cool things they're saying to be more my language. Sometimes I'm a guitar part guy, you know, very seldomly, but sometimes guitar part guy, sometimes a lyric guy, sometimes a melody guy. I've kind of fallen into this. I feel like there's a an originality developing in some of the cadence and stuff in my melodies, and I've been excited to hear some of those kind of come to life. Like Rocket Science song on the record right now, I really love that song. Just the flow of the melody and everything. So I would like to say that I'm fairly diverse. I just try to let whoever is on fire in the room be on fire in the room. And go from there. Some of these songs, I don't have to finish a song in 3 hours, man. I hate doing that. If we're on a great idea, let's get it going somewhere. And Rocket Science, we took 2 years to write, and which is ironic with the name of it being Rocket Science. But you know, we met up several times. So, anyways,
I figured just because of you saying you did poetry and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You would have a lot more emphasis on the lyrics side of things. That from your, like listening to your music, your words are very like descriptive and.
Yeah, I mean, Sundays in the South. You know, that song I had half written, went into the right with that one. Finished the miles. You know, sometimes I'll go off by myself and finish stuff. It's hard for me sometimes in a room to be able to. Get the stuff out the right way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I gotta get in the right headspace. I gotta be by myself, and sometimes I need a little bit of a buzz, you know, or whatever. But
ain't that right?
Yeah.
Good luck. I'll be out on the road, man.
Hey, man, thank you. Thank you for having me. This is awesome. And, dude, I wish so bad that my wife could have made it. She turned me onto the show early in our marriage, and she's been a big fan of the show for a long time. I think she talked to you one time on the phone. Y'all were doing a
stunt. The one. She's the one from what was the town in Kentucky?
Somerset.
She's
Somerset.
The one from no. Somerset. That
so you need to. Y'all need to call her back up. We can get a couple $100. But no, you guys were doing a stunt where there was an Uber driver, and you were going to like do something to the Uber driver in an engagement ring or something. And I don't know if it was Eddie or Lunchbox. Yeah,
we were seeing if the Uber driver would propose
yeah.
for somebody else. Like, drive the ring across town and propose.
She pulls up, and she sees him, and she's like, oh, no. And they opened the door, and she was like, I'm listening to the show.
Wait, she was the one that was
the She was the one, yeah.
That's funny.
Wow. Yeah,
that yeah funny. Small world. All right. Hey, good to talk to you, man. Big fan.
You too, buddy. Thank you so much.
Really big fan. You guys, lvshane.com, Backslider, the name of the – I'm saying the record name, right?
Backslider,
I'm
yes,
sir. I'm going from memory here, so.
Good deal. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Backslider is the name of the record. And you guys go see a show if he's around. LB Shane.
Come see me.
All right, there you go.